The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And ultimately, it comes down not just to a question of cybersecurity, but one of messaging. There is a sense in which we can have the conversation about how vulnerable our election systems are, how uncertain we should be about the results, in a way that actually achieves the end. Because we're all talking about how insecure it is, all of a sudden Americans are thinking, geez, did we really elect this person? Can we really trust the outcome of our vote? And in some ways, we have achieved our adversary's own goal. Now, the prevention of that is not just to put our heads in the sand, but we do need to have a really careful conversation that addresses the real vulnerabilities, talks about solutions in a way that at the same time is sensitive to not wanting to actually create the bad outcome of undermining that overall confidence. So that's a very delicate dance. And I think it's one reason why it's really important to have the conversation right now, far enough out of the next elections, that we can have sort of a non-political, non-partisan conversation about how we're going to address these issues moving forward.
I'm Vanessa Sauter, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 16th, 2017. The evidence of foreign interference in the 2016 U.S. elections emphasizes the significant national security threat to our democracy. Last week, Susan Hennessy joined a panel at the Brookings Institution to address the national strategy for protecting U.S. elections with retired four-star general John Allen, Alex Halderman of the University of Michigan, and Dean Logan, the president for the California Association of Clerks and Election Officials. Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow in foreign policy, moderated the conversation. Panelists explored the nuances of impacted voter participation and confidence in the broader context in which elections occur, as well as address the current cybersecurity risks in election infrastructure. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 247, Protecting U.S. Elections.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Michael Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program, but we have a ecumenical cross-program team here from not just Brookings, but across the country to discuss the crucial issue of foreign interference in American elections, especially through cyber means, but more generally, the national security threat to our democracy that we saw vividly last year and that remains unresolved. We've got a remarkable panel that I'll introduce in just a second. Let me please first remind you a little bit of the nature of the issue and where we stand in trying to address it. On the latter point, just as a little metaphor for where we stand, I'm wearing my lucky shamrock tie today, not because it's St. Patrick's Day, but because this seems to be about the extent of our national strategy so far on how to deal with this threat, which is hope for the luck of the Irish. I don't think we've gotten a lot beyond that, and today's panel is going to help us figure out how we can do better. I am not the expert. They are. All four of them have extensive experience in the broader issues of cyber at one level or another, and also elections, and I'll get to that in just a moment. I want to remind you very briefly of the stakes, and I'm sure most people in this room are well aware that on January 6th, a multi-agency report of the U.S. intelligence community asserted with high confidence that there had been significant meddling in the 2016 elections that probably did not change vote tallies per se, but that, you know, could have done a lot of other things. And I'm just going to very briefly read from a couple of the key findings of that report. We assess with high confidence that Russian military intelligence used the Guccifer 2.0 persona and DCLeaks.com to release U.S. victim data obtained in cyber operations publicly and in exclusive ways to media outlets and relayed material to WikiLeaks, and also that Russian intelligence obtained and maintained access to elements of multiple U.S. state or local electoral boards. Since that time, which is now almost, it seems, a lifetime ago in American politics, we've had a number of other reports, including something Michael Chertoff wrote about this week in the Wall Street Journal, big problems in Chicago with hacking into databases of voters there. We've had some New York Times stories about how various kinds of voter registrations that were being done electronically seem to have been hacked into, may or may not have impeded the actual vote tallies. Didn't seem to change any votes, but certainly slowed down voting even on election day. So we are perilously close to a situation where even the last elections may have actually been affected in their outcome in some ways, leaving aside all the issues of false news and information operations along those lines. And we're not necessarily any better to being prepared for the next time around. So today's panel is going to help us figure that out. And again, I'm delighted that all of you are here as well. Immediately to my left is my good friend and co-director for our defense team here at Brookings, General John Allen, retired General Allen. Of course, he's a Marine, and Marines love to tell you that they're not big thinkers, but I think we can decisively put that theory to rest at a time when we've got the James Mattises and John Kellys of the world holding together a lot of the executive branch. And retired General Allen is working a good deal on artificial intelligence as one of his main research areas, including on the very issue of election security that we're talking about today. Next to him is my good friend and colleague, Susan Hennessy, from our governance studies program here at Brookings. She's also the managing editor of the runaway hit Lawfare. She is a graduate of Harvard Law School and alum also of the National Security Agency, where she worked on these issues from the inside, but has been one of the most prolific and illuminating writers here at Brookings on these topics, and frankly, one of the most illuminating writers in the entire country. Thrilled to have her part of the panel. Just to her left is Alex Halderman, who is a professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Michigan, where he also runs a program on computer security and society. You might call him a patriotic hacker of sorts, in the good sense of the word. He has been involved, and I'm maybe taking some liberties with that term, but his bio emphasizes that he's been involved in testing various American cyber operations of electoral registrations, vote count systems, et cetera, to see how easily they could be hacked, and therefore to try to figure out how severe problems were. He's done this in regard to D.C., California, and he's been active around the world in helping improve election security from India to a number of other countries as well. We're just thrilled that he flew in from Michigan to join us today. And even further away is Dean Logan, who came on the red eye overnight from Los Angeles, California, where he is the registrar recorder and also the county clerk for the county of Los Angeles, and therefore oversees and is officially responsible for elections in the most diverse and largest county, single jurisdiction, local election system in the country. So he's seen it all in a part of the country that, again, combines all the different elements of cyber risks and concerns that we see today. He's also the president of the California Association of Clerks and Election Officials and is involved in a number of initiatives out there as well. The format for today will be that we'll essentially go down the row and then back with two big questions I'm going to pose sequentially to each panelist, and then we'll go to you for the second half of the discussion with your questions and concerns. And so, John, if I could begin with you, and again, it's going to be essentially the same question for everyone, but I may rephrase it slightly from person to person. If you could just help us understand how you see the nature of the problem today, the threat to American democracy and elections from foreign interference through cyber.
Oh, Mike, thanks very much. And ladies and gentlemen, it's terrific to have you here with us at Brookings this morning and to share the panel with three magnificent authorities on this subject, Susan, Alex, and Dean. And Mike, to your tie, my name doesn't sound like it, but I am also Irish, and I had this moment of panic that I had missed St. Patrick's Day. So I guess I did, actually, and wondered whether it was today or not. And to the Marine Force, the Marine Four Stars who are wandering around Washington, I'll add a fourth to that number, and that's a fellow by the name of Joe Dunford,
Thank
who's
you.
The current chairman. Look, my concern is one that's based in many respects upon both our national and our national security, but also our domestic security. I stood in front of the National Association of Counties about 2 months ago at their annual convention. And I gave them a brief on what I believe to be a systematic, large-scale strategic influence campaign that for the first time in my life, over 40 years wearing the uniform, after having participated in multiple conflicts overseas in Iraq, Afghanistan, against the Islamic State, I looked at that group in the audience, and I said, you know, I always felt pretty proud of being a Marine that I could say I was part of the first line of defense of the United States of America, and that I had spent most of my life defending the institutions of American democracy. But I then said to them with complete sincerity, I now think that you, the leaders of the counties of America, in many respects, are the front line of defense of the most profoundly essential institution of American democracy, and that's our voting. And protecting our voting system and our voting records and the integrity of the system. I think two things have happened now as a direct result of this Russian campaign. And let me just make a quick point about the Russian strategic campaign. Russians have got a lot of help in this. And whether it's the Chinese entity, which I think is less involved specifically on electoral intrusion, or whether it's Unit 180 of the North Koreans, who, using that entity or another organization called Lazarus, might in fact be attempting to strike the American electoral system and electrical system as a direct result of some of the problems we're having now today, or the Iranian cyber army, or the Syrian electronic army, or the digital caliphate of ISIL. These organizations have a lot of capacity to share assets and resources across their capabilities. My very sincere concern is to prevent a conversation like this from going immediately to the issue about cyber defense. And we'll have to talk about that because that's a very important part of it. But one of the most important outcomes of the Russian influence campaign, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, is not just to have the capability of intruding into records and processes, but frankly, to shake the confidence of the American voter in that most profoundly important aspect of the American democracy, which is our voting, which is what defines us as a great democracy. And so not just have we seen that here in the United States, I spend a great deal of my time overseas, and in particular in Western Europe, and in particular working on issues associated with NATO. And we've seen that the same influence campaign, which not only leverages relatively advanced cyber capabilities, but an influence campaign where those cyber capabilities are tucked up inside a broader narrative, which is supported by the intrusion of fake news into social media and the use of social media itself, and organizations of trolls, which ultimately comment on the news that they have seen and then further echo it and further retransmit it. It's a very sophisticated campaign. And so we see that institutions like the EU and NATO are under direct attack in this regard to shake the confidence of the people in the institutions, to shake the confidence of the people in their own governments, and to shake the confidence of the people in their processes ultimately for the selection of their leadership in these liberal democracies, which is basically all we've got left is this organization of liberal democracies. So as a guy who spent a lot of time overseas dealing with what I believe to be threats to America, I now recognize that at the speed of light, the very heartland of America is under threat today. And I stood in front of the county leadership with all sincerity and told them that the enemy has moved beyond my reach, both in terms of my retirement, but also in terms of our capacity to deal directly with this issue. And now, in many respects, the first line of the defense of American democracy and the last line of defense of American democracy is in the hands of our states and in our counties. And so, Mike, that's my concern, and I'll stop there.
Thank you, John. Extremely well couched and sets us up wonderfully to go next to Alice. Susan, if you don't mind, I'll save you for the Bryce Harper position in the batting order and ask Alex to now frame for us the problem. And again, after we go down and begin to understand the problem, we're going to come back through the same lineup and ask for solutions. So that's the basic format for this morning, as you probably have surmised already. But, Alex, over to you.
All right, so continuing with the problem, and I have to thank you, that's just such a wonderful way to set things up, because I couldn't agree more that we're unfortunately living in a world where the states and even the counties and local municipalities running elections are suddenly on the front lines of international conflict. But I want to focus my remarks on the state of vulnerability in our election system, because when we ask, well, are we having a crisis of voters not having sufficient confidence in elections? One really important piece of that is, well, how much confidence should we rationally have in the results of our elections? Are our elections able to provide us with high confidence the way they're being conducted today? And much of my research in cybersecurity over the past 10 years has been looking at the election equipment, the election implementations, the computer voting machinery that powers American elections and elections around the world. And I can tell you, based on that experience, I don't have a lot of confidence. So let me explain a little bit about some of the vulnerabilities in election equipment. American elections today are highly computerized. We rely on computers to manage our registration system, often to manage check-in at the polling place, in many states to count the votes, to receive them from votes and count them, and then finally to tabulate them from across the state and report the outcome. All of these different steps rely on different kinds of computer infrastructure. The infrastructure for voting, maybe that's the piece of infrastructure that people in this room will have had the most direct experience with, consists of two primary styles of voting machines. Either optical scan machines, where the voter fills out a ballot and then usually puts it through a computer scanner right in the polling place, or puts it in a ballot box to be later scanned at a central location. Or the other style is what's called DRE, or direct recording electronic voting machines, where the voter interacts with some kind of computer or electronic machine that will take their vote and record it in an electronic memory. Both of these styles of machines, the optical scan machines and the DRE machines, have been, in many cases across the country, now the models in use have been taken into research laboratories by independent security experts or academics. And in virtually every case where such a study has been conducted by a qualified group, the findings are that the machines have vulnerabilities that could allow someone to hack in and alter the software that's running on them in ways that would potentially allow an attacker to change votes. But this is these are findings that have been found in state-sponsored studies in California and Ohio, findings that I've found myself in my own work. One story, for instance, 10 years ago, my research group, while I was a grad student at Princeton, we got our hands on the most widely used touchscreen voting machine in the United States, the Diebold AccuVote TS. The manufacturer claimed very, very good, high level of security. After a couple of months of reverse engineering this machine in the laboratory, well, we had found that basically there was no effective security in this machine. With just momentary physical access to the memory card that's used to program the ballot before the election, we could insert vote-stealing software that would then reprogram the machine and cause it to forever after behave dishonestly and select whoever we wanted as the winning candidate. Now, you don't even need physical access to the machines to perform this kind of attack because, as I mentioned, before every election, essentially every voting machine in the country needs to be programmed with the design of the ballot. Who are the candidates? What are the races? Study after study has shown ways that by corrupting that ballot design file, you can introduce malicious software into the machine, essentially like a computer virus would spread. Those ballot designs are created on other systems called election management workstations that could be operated by the county or could be operated by an independent contractor. If someone can hack into those machines, which often aren't very well protected, then they can spread malicious software, vote-stealing software, to voting machines over a very wide area, a state, maybe a county, maybe a large portion of a state. In Michigan, for instance, 75% of counties use just two small independent contractors to do this pre-election programming. Those are just the biggest bullseyes I can imagine for sophisticated attackers. So we have a problem of insecure equipment. We have a problem of registration systems on the internet that have, we know in 2016, DHS says at least 21 state registration systems were probed in an attempt to break into those online databases. We know that At least one vendor of election equipment was targeted by attackers in 2016 in an attempt to break into their systems and thereby spread infiltration attempts to their customers, the local municipalities. So we know that these attacks are no longer just purely hypothetical. They're now things that powerful, sophisticated adversaries are attempting. Now, whether any of them have succeeded so far, we don't in changing votes and actually influencing the output of the election infrastructure. Well, we don't have any strong evidence that that has happened yet. But I think it's only a matter of time. 10 years ago, when I started this, if you had asked me, is it possible that foreign governments could hack into American elections and change the result? I would have said, well, maybe that's a theoretical possibility, but it sounds like science fiction. Well, today we're hearing about nation-state cyber attacks every day, including attacks against some of the most well-hardened targets. Our election systems are known to be vulnerable, and they are being targeted, and it's only a matter of time until an attack succeeds.
Thank you. Very stark and sobering framing of the problem, but very clear as well, and appreciate the technical primer. Let me ask one quick follow-up before going to Susan. In light of what you just said, what's your best guess as to why apparently Russia didn't change vote outcomes in 2016, that they just didn't try, or that they might have tried but just not quite gotten around to it yet, but next time they probably will?
Oh, that's just such an excellent question, and I wish we had all of the information that the intelligence community has available to them, and I'm not sure that they haven't given us a lot to go on to answer that particular question. My best guess, though, would be that there has long been a pretty strong norm against cyber attacks on election systems. I think that's a norm that our government has maintained, right? We certainly have the capability to hack into other people's election systems. And so going that extra step and hacking into ours would have been a severe escalation of the of cyber warfare. My best guess is that they were afraid of the retaliation that they would receive, especially after it became apparent that the Obama administration was aware of some of the attacks that were happening. I'd love to know what others' best guesses are.
Good. Thank you. Susan, over to you. And again, the same question, just how would you define the basic problem?
So first, I wish I could show the audience all of your faces as Alex was speaking and your sort of jaws were dropping, as were all of ours. So look, we shouldn't kid ourselves here. I think we should be candid and frank about the nature of the problem and how, frankly, terrifying it is. But there really are two different ways we should be thinking about sort of our electoral system, our election infrastructure. And one is the broader context in which elections occur, the sort of process of public debate and information and sort of all the things that surround elections that are important parts of how we go and make that, you know, sort of critical core democratic choice that General Allen was discussing. And then the second is the actual management and administration of elections. And I do think we have to think about those two things sort of in separate buckets, because the threats and solutions and the risks are quite different. So in terms of the threat to that broader context, things like disinformation campaigns, we know the threat is high, we know it materialized, we know it will happen again. And it will happen again until we candidly address it as a country. There's complex solutions, and in some cases they're going to come up against core values like freedom of speech, and those are going to be difficult questions, but they are ones that we're going to have to address. The second issue, that bucket of election management and administration that Alex was really speaking to, is the more complex and potentially pernicious threat. I feel relatively confident, although less so after hearing you speak, that Donald Trump is president of the United States because the appropriate number of Americans in the appropriate jurisdictions actually went and pulled the lever for him. And I think that's a really important thing, that Americans can have that level of confidence, that whatever we think about the broader context, our fellow citizens went and made a democratic choice, and that that choice is being lived out at the moment. The second sort of issue, though, however, is the confidence that we might have. So we don't actually, you don't actually need to target all of the various electoral systems, hack all the right machines that are different in the right counties. That requires quite a bit of sophistication, a political sophistication, knowing where to target. The other issue is that. So it requires political sophistication in knowing where to target. You also have to do it without detection. So you might be able to do something without forensic detection, but you also have to be able to do it without the detection of our intelligence community. So I do agree that it would be good if the intelligence community could come forward, provide more information. They're in the difficult position of trying to protect sources and methods, so they have challenges of their own. But that's a pretty difficult challenge right now, so I don't know that that risk has materialized. There is, however, something that's far easier to do, and that's to undermine confidence and to create and to insert real questions about the outcomes of elections. And all you really need to do for that is to penetrate systems such that it raises questions for smart people who say, I'm not positive anymore that this election, that this outcome is actually valid. And that is sort of the broader question that we're all going to have to address. And ultimately, it comes down not just to a question of cybersecurity, but one of messaging. There is a sense in which we can have the conversation about how vulnerable our election systems are, how uncertain we should be about the results, in a way that actually achieves the end. Because we're all talking about how insecure it is, all of a sudden Americans are thinking, geez, did we really elect this person? Can we really trust the outcome of our vote? And in some ways, we have achieved our adversary's own goal. Now, the prevention of that is not just to put our heads in the sand, but we do need to have a really careful conversation that addresses the real vulnerabilities, talks about solutions in a way that at the same time is sensitive to not wanting to actually create the bad outcome of undermining that overall confidence. So that's a very delicate dance. And I think it's one reason why it's really important to have the conversation right now, far enough out of the next elections, that we can have sort of a non-political, non-partisan conversation about how we're going to address these issues moving forward.
Thank you. And Dean, to stay with the baseball metaphor, batting cleanup from the land of the Los Angeles Dodgers, who we all in Washington are terrified by, maybe a little bit less so the last couple of weeks. But we are, don't worry. And thank you again for flying across the country to address this important topic with us. And we'd love to begin with the same question to you. Just how do you define the problem and its seriousness?
Great. Well, thank you first for the opportunity to be here and appreciate the It's very humbling to be on a panel with people with this expertise and background in these issues. And I appreciated your introduction. I'll riff off of that a little bit and say that I think key to this discussion, I think that the real point here from an election administrator standpoint is I haven't seen it all. I've seen a lot as an election administrator, but I think that that's a central message to what we're talking about here is none of us have seen it all, and there's more to come. And I think that from a practitioner standpoint is kind of the defining issue, is that we are now in a position where we have to anticipate those things that are known, but also prepare ourselves to deal with those things that aren't known. And I appreciated the way that the discussion was framed by General Allen, and always appreciate Alex's doom and gloom framework that scares us all and makes me long for my days of being a shoe salesman instead of an election administrator. So I appreciate being able to do cleanup because I also really appreciated Susan's perspective about how we message this, and I think I'll try to kind of piece this together from my standpoint. First, to say that the threat is real. I mean, certainly, I don't have to reframe that based on what we've all heard today and what we've seen. We wake up every day and hear about new vulnerabilities, new attacks, new information or theories about what happened during the 2016 election and what could happen in the future. This morning, we wake up to an article about the vulnerabilities of the German electoral system and their upcoming election, which goes to the broader framework that General Allen talked about. We're also reading today about the massive data breach from Equifax, and all of those things are relevant to the discussion we're talking about. So, as election administrators, we have to be aware of that, and we have to recognize that and recognize that that is a part of our responsibility now. It's not solely our responsibility, so I was encouraged to hear General Allen say that he was making that presentation before the National Association of County Officials because hopefully that same conversation, and I know it is happening in forums like the National Conference of State Legislators, because this is not something that can be resolved or combated simply at the local election administrator level or even state election administrator level. We operate in a decentralized environment that has many advantages to that, but we also operate in an environment where elections in this country, by and large, are under-resourced in terms of just raw funding, but also under-resourced in terms of training, expertise, and equipment to combat the kind of things we're talking about. So in one sense, that's daunting. In another sense, it's encouraging, and I agree, this is the time that we need to be having this conversation. I will say it's not a new conversation in the election administration field. We've been having this conversation for quite some time, and there is important work being done in this space, but there's more that needs to be done. We need to recognize that this is an influence campaign, and I think that one of the dangers historically that we have seen in the elections process is we tend to spend all of our time focused on looking at what happened in the last election and diagnosing that, and not looking forward to what could happen in the next election. I'm not saying that they're mutually exclusive. Both have to be done. I mean, we should learn from what happened in 2016 as we prepare for 2018 and 2020. But we can't get so stuck in the weeds of what happened in 2016 or what was perceived to happen in 2016 that we find ourselves the month, the week, the day before the election in 2018 and unaware of those things that we don't know that are happening in the current election cycle. And I guess I would close by saying that the other thing that I think is we have to look at this from a holistic standpoint. Yes, what's new is this this nation state influence, and that's big, it's daunting, and it's we've got to pay attention to that. That doesn't take away from the additional threats and vulnerabilities that were already existent in our election system and that we're working towards. So we have to look at this holistically, and we have to look at the way it's framed to the electorate. Because the other crisis we have that I think we have to be very aware of is we have a crisis of participation. When we have the electorate waking up every day hearing reason to believe that they shouldn't have confidence in the 2016 election or that they shouldn't have confidence in the ultimate power of their vote, which is the foundation of our democracy, what that leads to is lower voter participation. And in the end, if we put all the resources necessary, which is a big if, in combating the issues that we've talked about this morning and create a secure system is of no value to our democracy if people aren't participating in the election, if people aren't showing up and voting and making the decisions that that are left to the electorate to make in this country and that we value. And we are seeing slippage in that. And so we need to be sure that we are conveying a message about where voters can get the right information, what are the trusted sources of information. We need to be honest and upfront about the environment we're working in as we're working through the threats. And we need to convey a sense that the best offense is participation and that complacency and lack of participation is not going to be an effective defense to this threat.
That's excellent. And before I start with you and then come down the row asking for what we need to do about the problem, especially what we need to do that we're not yet contemplating or making happen, I want to follow up with one quick additional question that you've all made me think of in listening to your openings. And that is, understanding the nature of the cyber threat to our elections, there are several categories of concern. There's the concern about sort of false news and propaganda. There's the concern about email theft and release, the WikiLeaks DNC kind of thing. I was well aware of those two before today, and I think most people were. Then there's the concern about the interference in the sort of processing and the event of the election and the voting itself. And that's what some of the New York Times and Wall Street Journal reporting and Bloomberg and others have been sensitizing us to, that there were some efforts to complicate people's access to their vote. And then there's the Alex scenario of actual votes being changed, if not already, then someday. So those four categories, sort of propaganda, false news, social media, misuse, and then theft of email and sort of disclosures that are embarrassing or harmful, and then slowing down or putting molasses or interfering with access to the vote, and then changing the vote. If those are four categories of threat, which is the most serious so far, and which is that going to be the one that's the most serious next time? And maybe that's too vague of a question, but I hope you can at least help me think it through a little bit, because I think I heard from Alex that hypothetically the last category could become a much greater concern, even if it wasn't last time. But I want to see if others would rank order these threats, if the question makes any sense to you at all. If I'm just spouting gibberish, feel free to tell me so, and we'll go on to the next question.
Well, I think a lot of that depends on where you sit and what your role is in the process. So I think it's hard to prioritize one over the other. I think, and you probably can guess this from my remarks, I think for me as an election administrator, the most immediate threat is this crisis of confidence and crisis in participation. Because in my world and in my operation, while we're between elections, that's another thing that is often misperceived. The next election for me isn't in 2018. The next election for me is the first week of October. Yeah. So I mean, so we are constantly in an election mode, and we have to continue. I mean, the health of our democracy depends on continuing to conduct elections and continuing to let that process go forward. And as I said, if people aren't participating, then we're losing in that battle. And arguably, if people aren't participating, the chaos that General Allen talked about has been created, and they've successfully derailed our election system without even having to hack it.
Yep. Or go to war with us.
Right. Yeah, so I think you're right. It depends where you sit. These are all serious threats, though. And I think we can simplify the taxonomy just a little bit into kinds of information warfare and kinds of cyber attacks against election infrastructure. We've seen attacks in both of those categories in 2016, and I think we're going to see them become only more sophisticated going forward. So we need a strategy for defending against both information warfare and attacks on election infrastructure.
Good. Thank you. Susan, any comment?
So I broadly agree. We're going to have to learn how to walk and chew gum at the same time on this. We have immediate threats and we have long-term threats. And ignoring, you know, one at the expense of the other is sort of a recipe for disaster. I think what we need to understand holistically is this is the core of our democracy. This is not some, you know, tangential issue that comes up once every 2 or 4 years when we're all thinking about it. You know, this is really what it means to be American. This is a central, you know, the fact that we only just designated it critical infrastructure coming up to the last election, as opposed to recognizing it as critical infrastructure, sort of the most critical infrastructure from the outset, really speaks to the need for a pretty strong wake-up call. And for the necessary sort of resources and awareness that should follow.
John, any thought on that question?
Yeah, it's a tough question, very complex. I think from my own experience working counterterrorism issues, much more human behavior has been a result of perception than reality in so many ways. And to Dean's really important point, and the panel has touched this, the enemy wins if the American voter perceives that there is no value ultimately to going to the polls anymore. Because no matter what I do, it isn't going to make a difference. There's the potential that my vote has been compromised. There is the potential that the system overall will not register my or the population's views as members of a democratic society. And so we have to do several things. At the ground level, because all politics is local and by coincidence all voting appears to be local, it doesn't make any difference when John Allen shows up in front of a conference and briefs county executives or county officials on the problem. What matters is what happens as a direct result of that, or what happens as a result of the activities occurring at the county as well. And I think there's the twofold dimension to this. One is that county officials and state officials have to constantly be educating the voter that it is an inherent responsibility in a democracy as such as ours for Americans to go forward and vote. You know, we are very quick to point out all the things the government should be doing for us in a democracy. But inherent to a democracy functioning is the voter or the members of the population, assuming the responsibility for the strength of the democracy as well. And in a very real way, the strength of the democracy of the United States is founded upon our capacity to register our opinions through the voters, through the voting process. So first and foremost, I think Dean made an extraordinarily important point, and that is we have got to teach the American voter that the enemy wins if we cease to vote. The enemy wins if we have struck an absence or created an absence of confidence or a crisis of confidence in the process. But then the county and state officials have to do all they can to try to resolve the issues that Alex has talked about, which is to bring us to a system that may be proof from interference. And of course, we know that there's virtually no system on the planet that is proof from interference. But there is the capacity, and we know this as time has gone on, there is the capacity to layer mechanisms of defense and systems of defense that can give you a relatively high confidence. But the problem is, because so much of the voting process in the United States is local, the problem is there are very unleveled approaches from county to county and state to state across the country. One of the reasons is because we don't impose federal standards on this process. So the more we can do at the county level and state level to help our officials at that level to understand the problem, and clearly we have one of the leaders in the country sitting on this panel right now in terms of both understanding it and embracing the solutions. That's not the case in other places, and I've had very intimate conversations on this with other counties where their capacity for cyber defense or cyber protection is very, very limited. And until we're able to provide both education and resources to try to support the integrity, the electoral integrity, the cyber integrity of those systems, then we're going to have difficulty in ensuring that American voters have confidence in their system as well. That's our challenge right now. It's a two-headed challenge.
So thank you. And now let me ask, starting with Dean, so what do we need to do that we're not doing? And how much help, by the way, do you need and want from Washington, recognizing that elections are local and state responsibilities for the most part, recognizing that sometimes it's even hard to have the conversation with Washington about the problem because you get into classification issues, local officials may not have the clearances, recognizing that Washington doesn't seem able to pass budgets to help even when it wants to on some issues. So what do we need to do about these problems specifically, and what would you like to see Washington help you with the most?
So I think first and foremost, it's acknowledging the threat, recognizing the threat, which we've already talked about. And then I think we have to frame it in the context that we've just had here. I think it is going to require layered solutions, and what we need from Washington versus what we need in our local jurisdictions or in our states is going to vary as much as the election jurisdictions do around the country. I think that right now we're at a place where the critical thing is information sharing. We need to be sharing information. We need to be sharing information in a timely manner. We need to be sharing information in a context that's that can be absorbed and understood by the people that we're talking to. And that means election administrators are one audience for that. But as I said before, county councils, state legislators, and county information security officers and state information security officers are key components of that. This is not something that, as you say, in most jurisdictions, or as General Allen said, in most jurisdictions, this is not something that the election administrator themselves is going to have the capacity or expertise to tackle. I will say on a positive note, I think that train has left the station, and I think that's evidenced by, I can tell you as an election administrator, it's evidenced by how frequent the communication on these issues is happening in the space right now. It's evidenced by the fact that we have two members of the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission sitting in this room today for this dialogue, who I hear from on a daily or if not weekly basis on these issues. By the way, not just post-2016, but pre-2016 elections and during the election cycle. It's evidenced by the decision to make the critical infrastructure designation. A lot of questions about what that means and how those resources are going to be distributed and how that ultimately functions. So there's frustration around that because it's new and some information is not coming as timely as we would like it. But I think that there are signs that's happening. I think it's recognizing that it's shared responsibility. So I talked about that before. And then I think it gets down to kind of the nuts and bolts, and that's where I go back to my comment about the next election is next week for a lot of jurisdictions. So, yes, we have to figure out what we need from Washington in terms of resources, what we need from our state legislators, but we also need to figure out what we need for next week. And for next week, we need policies like solid commitments to post-election audits, risk-limiting audits, a commitment to a standard of a tangible paper ballot of record that you can go back and verify the totals. That was an interesting point made in the articles today about the vulnerabilities in the German election, was that ultimately they have a paper ballot that they can go back to. But again, a paper ballot's not of value unless you actually do go back to it and check it against something on a regular basis. So so we lack, in some cases, we lack good best practices and good clear policies in that regard. So I think that's an important place to start. I say that because the reality is that the systems that we need that will best combat this aren't on the market today. We operate in an election environment with a very limited market, a very proprietary market, which I'll link to the stories about the Equifax vulnerability and the timeliness of when that information was provided. And when you operate with proprietary systems that are commercially based, we as the public officials that run elections don't have control of when we get the information about a potential hack or vulnerability. We need to address that too. We need to create an environment where when something happens, I mean, to steal a line from TSA, when you see something, say something. And so if you see in a particular state or on a particular voting system that there's a potential vulnerability or a potential intrusion, we need to create an environment where it's safe to talk about that. And it's safe to talk about that and to create a mutual aid process in response to that. Parallel to that, we need to be working towards a systems infrastructure that doesn't rely on proprietary processes, that is publicly owned and that is resourced at a level that is appropriate to this kind of threat. And it's not today. Elections are one of the least funded parts of our governance. It's difficult to go and compete with other critical public needs. And so we need to find a way to have a place at the table to have that dialogue, but also we need to be realistic about that there are a lot of needs that need to be met. So we can't expect that there's just going to be a huge infusion of federal or state money. And even when there is an infusion of money, we need to be sure that money is spent effectively. That's right. One of the things, in retrospect, with HAVA, a lot of positive things from the Help America Vote Act. So I certainly don't want to stand here and be on record being critical of that. But the reality is that the reactive infusion of federal money into the elections process after the Bush v. Gore decision created a rush to market of systems that were trying to solve a symptom of the problem, but we're not ready to solve the ultimate problem, and we're still today dealing with the ramifications of that.
Thank you. Great comments.
Alex, same question to you, please.
All right. Well, if I was doom and gloom in the what's the problem question, maybe I can paint a rosier picture of the solution. Because I think of all of the major problems we have in cybersecurity and critical infrastructure, the voting system is probably the easiest to secure. From a technical level, the solutions are straightforward. Dean has already gestured towards some of the most important pieces of that. But essentially what we need is a system that relies on physical fail-safes and something that is going to be simple so that local election administrators can be responsible for their own frontline defense. And that's what brings us back to paper and post-election audits. So President Trump said it very well on Election Day, that there's something nice about old-fashioned paper ballots. You don't have to worry about hacking. Well, that's absolutely true. A vote recorded on a piece of paper can't be retroactively changed by someone hacking into a computer. And there's been sustained growth in the fraction of the country that votes using paper. It's now up to about 70% of voters in 2016. We need to push that number towards 100% and upgrade the technology for voting in jurisdictions that are still voting with only computer records of the vote being retained.
And then, as Dean said, a paper isn't going to do you any good if you don't also look at it. But we can use paper records of votes as a kind of quality control mechanism to make sure that the computer counts are correct. And you do that by basically randomly sampling after the election the paper ballots and making sure that they record what the computers say they would. That's called a post-election audit. And with typical margins of victory, a very, very small random sample of the votes can give you high confidence that the overall outcome is correct. So by recording votes on paper, performing post-election audits, we can have a system that, using low-tech methods, gives people a reasonable basis for high confidence without having to trust any high-tech methods have worked. And it's something that would let the local election officials obtain that high confidence and potentially correct problems with the computer results have discovered without having to rely on the federal government and the intelligence community at all. Of course, not all the threats are threats of hacking into voting machines and changing votes. So we also need to raise the bar for other kinds of attacks, make it harder to sabotage machines and cause them to fail on election day, make it harder to break into registration systems and disrupt things. But these are just normal, everyday cybersecurity problems. We can apply the kinds of best practices we apply in industry and in government to election systems at the state level to help make those attacks more difficult. So things like training, things like penetration testing, threat analyses, these are widespread common best practices. We just need to make sure that that kind of training, that kind of information is getting to the local levels in election administration. I'm also more confident, I think, than Dean is about the odds of getting federal help to the states. I've been working on the issue of election security for the last decade, and I have never seen a year like this where people are still having a conversation about the security of elections this long after the last major election. It's usually something people forget about a couple of weeks after voting. And that includes people in Washington, that includes members of Congress. There's right now even a bipartisan bill sponsored by Senators Graham and Klobuchar that's been proposed as an amendment to the NDAA that would provide money to the states to implement paper ballots, election auditing, and cybersecurity best practices on a voluntary basis, basically empowering the states to take these steps if they choose. And I think that possibility of having federal resources available to the states that currently don't have the resources or don't have the expertise to implement better cyber defenses on the front lines, I think that's wholly appropriate. We don't ask the states to defend against physical attacks by foreign governments. Why should we be asking them to defend their election systems against cyber attacks from nation states? This is an appropriate place for the federal government to offer help.
Thank you. Very good. Susan.
Yeah, so I agree with all of that. And then I think there's sort of a multi-pronged approach. So first is having conversations like this and having them now. So we sort of talked about that earlier. But the more distance you have from the prior election and the next election, I think the more constructive the conversation can be. The second effort is you really do need to develop neutral standards. And these sort of these baseline rules will guard against things like believing that there's the appearance of politics infecting some of this decision making. So to the extent we can have best practices for security and also neutral standards for when we have recounts, when we believe the conditions have been met such that a recount is appropriate, that shouldn't just be when a candidate decides that that a recount should occur, but there actually should be a better and more even-handed administration of, hey, whenever we really do have a question, we want to go back to look at look at paper ballots or recount the votes. The third is that I think the Klobuchar-Graham bill is a great first step in terms of offering federal assistance. I do think that needs to continue to be a state-led effort. Elections are administered by states in the United States for a reason, and I do think that there will be persistent hostility, and for good reason, to sort of overly federalizing elections. But that should not inhibit us from offering voluntary federal resources to the states. That said, as much as I'm heartened by the Graham Klobuchar NDAA amendment, it's also a little bit sad, right, that this and these baby steps, these absolutely obvious things that we should be doing are the best we can do. We should be having a much more sophisticated conversation. We should be seeing far more robust and sophisticated pieces of legislation, funding efforts already. So good baby steps, but we're still nowhere close to where we need to be. And the final is that, you know, we need to reestablish some norms that were broken primarily in the prior election. And that's something that we haven't returned to, and I think that we need to. And we need to acknowledge that one of the reasons why there were conditions for a lack of confidence in the outcome of the election is because one of the candidates routinely described the American electoral system as rigged. One of the candidates said that they were not prepared to necessarily concede the election if they lost. At the end of the day, the election is all, it's an agreement among all of us to sort of respect this system. We want to have a candid, honest conversation about potential concerns, but we also need our politicians to behave responsibly. We need to demand that they behave responsibly whenever they talk about election outcomes. And that's something that was washed away a little bit sort of in the outcome of the election, but it really is something that we're going to need to think about and ask our elected members or aspiring elected members to be more responsible about moving forward.
Thank you. John Allen.
I'd have very little I could add to this wonderful laydown here. I would just simply say that the brief I gave to NACO, the National Association of Counties, had a chunk in it as well about critical infrastructure protection. And so while we are going to seek to try to preserve the integrity and the sanctity of the voting system, we are really on the edge, on the cusp of the potential for very vulnerable infrastructure attacks as well. And it argues for us to think entirely differently about the cyber protection that we are able both to bring to bear ourselves, but also to bring to bear on the networks and systems at the county level. For example, the WannaCry virus, which was out not long ago, when we did the DNA analysis on it, there was code in that process that pointed directly back towards a North Korean organization. And, of course, when WannaCry ultimately, which is a ransomware malware, ultimately registered itself, when it really shut down tens or hundreds of thousands of systems, it shut down systems in hospitals, it shut down systems in universities, it shut down police forces, et cetera, et cetera, every single one of which is a major concern at a critical infrastructure level at counties as well. So we have to think about all the really important electoral issues associated with the comments by the panelists this morning. But we also have to recognize that until we are willing to engage in cyber operations against a state that explicitly launches attacks against American critical infrastructure, we're going to have to try to defend ourselves with the best capabilities we can at the lowest level, the level closest to the public safety realities and the electoral realities within the population. And I would simply tell you that from my perspective, this means that we're going to need to embrace artificial intelligence, very importantly in that process. Cognitive end-based endpoint security is just about the only way we're going to be able to do this, because we have artificial intelligence coming at us now. And if we're able to help the counties to understand that and to ultimately think about the resources that they have available to them and perhaps think differently about those resources and structure them in different ways, not only to protect the electoral system, but also to protect the critical infrastructure with the right kinds of layered defenses, then we can protect the public, protect the electoral system, and then we can deal with the state and non-state actors as they continue to attack the United States, frankly.
Let me thank all of you, because there are a lot of people in this room who have asked outstanding questions, but also I know a lot of people who have done a lot of work on this very important question for our democracy. And let me also ask you to join me in thanking the panelists.
Well done. Well done.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Special thanks to Gaston Reborero for his editing support. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare podcast, share it on Facebook, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.